WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're digging into the issues around absentee ballots in New Hanover County. These were mail-in ballots that weren't part of election night totals because the County Elections Board had enacted an administrative cutoff that held back several days' worth of ballots and allowed them to be counted in the week and a half between Election Day and the canvass when votes are finalized. My colleague Kelly Knoyer and I will unpack what happened, a poorly communicated choice that was possibly unlawful and made due to insufficient resources to comply with new election regulations and high voter turnout. We'll also explore what didn't happen, namely election fraud. That's despite the claims of some high-profile local Republicans. Then, I'll be joined by my colleague Rachel Keith to take a closer look at campaign finance. Rachel recently published a deep dive into where support for our local candidates comes from, and you can find that in-depth report online. And she joins us today to recap some of the highlights and key takeaways. Plus, we'll touch on how anyone interested in campaign finance can access the public records on fundraising and spending. Knowledge is power, after all. But first, we're going to get into this absentee ballot issue. And with me to unpack all of it is my colleague Kelly Knoyer. Kelly, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start with election night. We were live on the air, and you came by at a certain point, and we were still waiting for even the initial election results.
Yeah, it was sort of unusual. On election night itself, I was hanging out with the Democratic Party's election night watch party. And typically during these things, you're seeing different precincts kind of rolling in over time. That was just not happening for many, many hours. We were seeing results from different states, seeing results from other parts of North Carolina, and there was no new information coming in for New Hanover County. I heard a lot of frustration from some of the organizers. I know that the party chair, Jill Hopman, was on the phone with the election director, Ray Hunter Havens, trying to figure out what was going on. It seems like there was just a snafu with uploading the election results. It was just on a couple of different thumb drives, and it took a long time for that data to get uploaded, which meant that it was hours of delay before we got any clear election results on election night.
Now, this is not directly related to the absentee ballot issue, but it kind of set the tone for the 2 weeks that was going to follow. And it was, in fact, in part due to new laws that constrict how boards of elections can count ballots. But I think the real drama really started the next day, on Wednesday, the day after Election Day, when we started hearing about extra ballots, like additional mail-in ballots.
And I think it's worth noting that some mail-in ballots had already been counted before Election Day. So for the longest time, the only results that were available were these limited results just from the mail-in responses that we had received. And I think pretty much everyone assumed, based on existing state statute, that that included every single ballot that had been mailed in before Election Day. And it turned out that was not true. The local election board decided to do this kind of administrative cutoff where they stopped counting the ballots that came in after Halloween, sort of held them in waiting until after Election Day to count them. But that meant that there was this tranche of votes that had not been tallied that everybody thought had already been tallied.
Yeah, exactly. Our expectations based on a new 2023 law was that really only the ballots that showed up on Election Day itself were going to be left over. And the way that the Board of Elections responded to our questions about this, again, sort of frustrated people. The suggestion was that this always happens. And that's kind of true, but it's also a little bit disingenuous. There have always been ballots that have shown up on Election Day that are counted later. And in the past, in 2022 and earlier years, there were ballots that actually showed up after Election Day during a 3-day grace period. So yes, every election that I've covered, there have been extra mail-in ballots that don't get counted until the canvass, which is like a week and a half later. But this year, we were expecting way fewer mail-in ballots. We got way more. So that in and of itself was kind of surprising, knowing that these ballots were going to skew considerably towards Democratic candidates, definitely concerned Republican candidates. And the suggestion that we were making a mountain out of a molehill here really frustrated the public, the press, and the candidates.
I think part of it, too, was that we didn't get a clear tally of how many ballots it was for several days. And there was a lot of guesstimating happening. And because we weren't getting direct communication from the election board, we weren't told that it was a guesstimate. They said over 1,500 ballots. We assumed it was approximately 1,500 to 1,600. And then that number kept creeping up and up and up as they estimated a little bit more carefully and then actually counted the total number of ballots that were left. But as it kept creeping up, there were all these questions questions of where are they finding these ballots?
Right. And so what happened was that, yeah, there was an initial visual inspection, and then they did a more thorough one. So it jumped from like 1,500 to 1,750. Ultimately, this number would grow to almost 2,000. And that was because there were mail-in ballots that came from overseas from people in the military. And those ballots under federal law still have to be counted. But during this time, so this is like the 3 days leading into the long Veterans Day weekend after Election Day, we had a lot of questions, and the Board of Elections and Elections Director Ray Hunter Havens was not directly answering questions. It was clear that the county was frustrated by this, and the way they kind of approached this lack of transparency, lack of communication, was kind of dumping emails from the county directly to the press. Ordinarily, you'd have to go to a terminal that's at the government building or do a public records request. They were just sending us emails that Chris Coudray was sending to county commissioners, kind of summarizing the latest. And the county's communications team was sort of helping us communicate with Hunter Havens, but we weren't able to communicate with her directly. And part of this is because the Board of Elections is a weird agency that's locally funded, but it's part of the state. It doesn't have its own legal counsel. It doesn't have its own PIO or communications person. So there's some reasons for this. But all of that came together to sort of create a fog of confusion around this. I will say one important takeaway that we had at the end of the first week, so Friday afternoon, we were reasonably sure that the Board of Elections had broken the law or stretched the law on when they were supposed to count these ballots. And we knew there was a lot of confusion caused by lack of communication about this decision. But there was no evidence going into that Veterans Day weekend that any ballots had been lost, the ballots had been created, that there was anything that you could call elections fraud.
At the same time, over that weekend, as there were building stresses, especially in the GOP, about the possibility that this election could flip seats, we were hearing from some influential members of the GOP that they didn't think these ballots should be counted, especially Woody White, who's a former county commissioner, former state rep, who said on Twitter that he thought that the chain of custody was in question for these ballots. There was no evidence of this, and suggested that they should not be counted. A very, very concerning thing to be hearing from a former elected official.
Yeah, and so this came out of like the last email we got from the county on Friday going into the weekend. White posted this on Saturday. And this was after Chris Coudray had learned that although earlier the local Board of Elections had said, hey, whatever we did sort of based on the guidance from the state. We got an email on Friday afternoon that we shared with the county where the state said, no, we did not tell them to do that. And the state had also defended Hunter Havens and, again, kind of chastised us for being too hard on her and saying that we should appreciate all the hard work that her and her team did. But when it came to whether or not the state had actually given them the okay to do this administrative hold after Halloween, they said, we did not do that. We shared this with the county as part of our back and forth. And Chris Coudray wrote an email in which he was clearly very upset, even angry, that he had sort of been, from his point of view, misled by the state board. He signed his email numb Chris Coudray. And so responding to that, to your point, White said that these ballots should be tossed. Candidate John Hinnett weighed in, calling it fraud. He wrote on X, election fraud is always something that happens elsewhere until your name is on the ballot where the fraud is happening. So pretty directly suggesting that there was fraud going on. Again, all of this is happening during the 3-day weekend, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, when we can't communicate with either the state or the county.
And to her credit, at this point, Ray Hunter Havens did step in. She eventually responded to some of these comments, especially those comments that we were hearing from Woody White. She said that it's shocking that he would call to interfere with someone's constitutional right to vote.
So this is on Tuesday of the week leading into the canvass, where the Board of Elections finally starts responding to some of our questions. White, who doesn't communicate with me very often, sent me a direct message on X saying you can update your story, and sent me a screenshot of what he'd posted, which was basically saying that he was frankly shocked that despite all of the resources that New Hanover County gives to the Board of Elections, that we had still been ranked 99 out of 100th of counties in the effectiveness of our election process. And so put a pin in that resource question because we're gonna come back to that.
And also put a pin in that 99th out of 100 because where did he get that from?
The only thing I can think about that is I think we may have actually been 99th out of 100 counties to report on election night.
But that has nothing to do with quality.
But it has nothing to do with quality. But again, so just to give you a sense of where we are, we've been through the long weekend where confusion is just allowed to simmer and in some cases boil over on social media. We come back on Tuesday night. The Board of Elections has a meeting. The board publicly responds to some of these concerns. Board Chair Derek Miller acknowledges that he told Hunter Havens, look, I want you to prioritize working on the canvas, the actual work of the elections, over answering questions from the public and the media. At the same time, the Board of Elections also gave their unanimous seal of approval to the fidelity and accuracy of the vote counting process. So that's basically their way of saying there is no fraud here, including, you know, there's two Republican members and three Democratic members. And they all said, you know, we support this.
I would say it's also worth noting that this is where we started in the week, hearing a little bit more from the Board of Elections about their concerns about how all of this had gone down. They were saying that part of the reason they did this administrative cutoff was because they didn't have sufficient resources to do the count in the time that was needed. And this is something that is in much dispute with the county.
Right. And I want to drill down into the details a little bit here because I think they matter. On Tuesday, we heard from the Board of Elections that, again, there were concerns. And we asked Chair Derek Miller point blank, you know, did you ask for more? And if you had had more resources, would this have happened? Would you have needed to do the administrative delay after Halloween? And Miller was pretty direct. He said, yes, we have asked for additional resources in the past. We were rejected. He said, if we had had more staffing, we wouldn't have had to do the administrative hold. More importantly, he also said that the county asked them to prepare lean budgets. I think this is what it really comes down to, because, yes, the Board of Elections had not asked for additional staff. They have eight staff members that the county pays for, including Hunter Havens. And that's been consistent for like the last 4 years. And the overall budget, which is just shy of $1.8 million, goes up and down a little bit because sometimes they'll have an extra election. But there's kind of the through line basic cost of running things. A large portion of that is those eight salaries. What the Board of Elections had asked for was increased funding for their temp workers. And these are not county employees, so they don't get paid at the county minimum wage. And that's what the Board of Elections was asking for, because this is a weird staffing situation where you're basically bringing on people to do intense, complicated work, crazy hours sometimes, but for a short seasonal period. And so to get people who are engaged and efficient and can be trusted with some of this work, the Board of Elections feels, at least, you have to pay these people more. So that's what they asked for. They asked to bump, pay from like $17 to $19 an hour for judges and chief judges on election day. They asked to bump daily rates like by $30 a day.
Mm-hmm.
So these are not huge asks, and the county did reject them.
One thing that I think is worth noting, too, is we're talking about these lean budgets. The county has had some of this pressure to try and keep the budgets lean, to not grow them very much beyond inflation or at all above inflation from year to year. But we've had so many changes to election law in recent years in North Carolina. You used to be able to count ballots before Election Day. Now you have to count all of the ballots on Election Day itself. And there's only so many hands counting so many ballots. So that question of the hours in the day, there's only 24 hours in Election Day. So can you physically manage it with the resources available? And we're hearing from the Board of Elections that it was not possible.
Yeah. And so I want to one final thing on this lean budget issue. We asked the county about Miller's comments, basically trying to dig into the implication that at some point in the budget process, the county had communicated to the Board of Elections that it should be pretty conservative with what it was asking for financially. And we do know that the sheriff's office during the last budget cycle got a huge chunk of additional funding to help them with recruiting and retaining, $18 million. We also know that the Register of Deeds turned in a smaller budget. They sort of voluntarily cut their own budget. So we also asked the county, you know, do you ask these other agencies to turn in lean budgets? Chris Coudray, through the county communications office, sent us an interesting and kind of terse response. And I want to read to you from that response.
Ooh, a dramatic reading. I can't wait.
Do we ask for efficiency? Yes. Do we expect tight margins? Yes. Do we have a detailed and deliberate budget process? Yes. Do we fund requests that align with our strategic priorities? Yes. Do we automatically say yes or no to enhancement requests? No. Do we ask departments to find innovative ways to handle routine business? Yes. Do we require departments to make a compelling case for their needs? Absolutely. He went on to say that when we asked him about the sheriff's office, that they had actually turned down some requests from the sheriff's office in the past, which is true. Then we got to the actual issue of lean budget, and this is what Coudray wrote. What exactly is meant by lean budgets? Is the implication that the alternative is, quote, fat, wasteful, or excessive? That's not how we approach budget planning in New Hanover County. We prioritize responsible, efficient use of taxpayer resources while ensuring departments have what they need to serve the community effectively. So from all this back and forth, it seems like from the county's point of view, they are giving the Board of Elections everything they need to do the job, increasing their funding over time and never penalizing them when they go over budget, which they have done in the past. But at the same time, it does seem like the county expects the Board of Elections to run a pretty tight fiscal ship, which includes finding, quote, innovative ways to handle routine business.
I see. Interesting. And I think the implication here, right, if you're the Board of Elections, what you're seeing is we made this request that would make it easier for us to do our jobs that does not actually add staffing, and we were told no, so it doesn't seem reasonable to assume that we would be told yes if we asked for further resources. So while we're hearing from some elected officials, we would give them anything they asked for. It's important to us that we can do this. What we are hearing from the unelected officials in the county is that that might not have been the subtle conversation happening behind the words, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's what officially happens in the budget request where Hunter Havens puts together a budget, the board approves it, and they send it to the county. And then there's the subtext and reading the room. Okay, well, that's a recap of some of the chaotic confusion that happened between Election Day and the canvass and kind of the budgetary backstory and context to it. Now, we've got to take a quick break, but my colleague Kelly Kinoyer and I will be back in just a moment to dig further into the story, talking about the election protest filed here in New Hanover County and some broader thoughts on election integrity. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. I'm here with my colleague Kelly Kinoyer as we continue to unpack the story of what happened with absentee ballots at the New Hanover County Board of Elections. And just to reset the timeline now, we are about a week after Election Day. This is the Tuesday evening going into Wednesday, the week of the canvass. That was Friday, November 15th, when the Elections Board was set to finalize the votes. And in the midst of debates about budgeting and whether or not the board had acted appropriately under state law, we learned that Republican Commissioner Dane Scalise, who is running for his first full term, had filed first a complaint and then a formal elections protest. So it's important to note that Scalise is not alleging fraud. If you read through his complaint, he doesn't suggest that there are ballots that mysteriously appeared or mysteriously disappeared, but he does call out the Board of Elections at the local level for breaking the law.
He specifically is complaining that the Board of Elections should not have done that administrative cutoff, and he's demanding that the Board of Elections immediately count the ballots that should have been tallied before Election Day. Unfortunately, this came out with about less than 48 hours notice before the canvass, so it did not happen before the canvass.
Yes, Scalise delivered his election protest on Tuesday. We wrote about it on Wednesday. His demand for an immediate count required a hearing to actually consider his protest, and the nearest meeting they could do it on would be Thursday when they were doing the count. And at this point, we also learned from Paul Cox, who is the general counsel for the State Board of Elections, that yes, he said categorically they should not have done this administrative hold. He didn't go so far as to say they broke the law, but he definitely said they should have counted these ballots, which lent a lot of credence to Scalise's complaint. The question wasn't whether or not Scalise was in the right. The question was how to provide the remedy he wanted, which was the opportunity for a representative to inspect the ballots, which does happen, as I understand it, where Democrats and Republicans both have volunteers who are part of the ballot overview process, and that he wanted them counted immediately. In fact, the date they set to hear his protest was the day after the ballots were actually counted. So on Thursday, the day before the canvass, we count the ballots. We get what are pretty close to the new totals. We know there are still some outstanding provisional ballots and some ballots that might be thrown out. But by the time we get to the actual canvass on Friday, when we do the voter protest hearing for Scalise, the votes he demanded to be counted have already been counted. And the ballots have been sort of seen by both Democratic and Republican volunteers.
So on Thursday, we essentially finally got the actual election results. And after all that buzz about there potentially being a flip from one seat to another, from somebody being off the board who thought they were going to be on, that did not happen.
Right. And there is a recount going on right now as we record this. But historically, these general election recounts have maybe moved the votes by 5 or 6. And the candidates who are fourth out of 3 spots need hundreds of votes to change the election. And we don't expect to see that happening.
So I want to say a few things about what happened during the canvass before the votes were finalized during this hearing for the protest, because we've gotten a lot of questions about this. The first is that, yes, this is a partisan board. It does have a 3-2 Democratic to Republican majority, and they did vote against a Republican's protest. And I think if the issue had been voter fraud, if it had been election integrity writ large, I think the press would have been a lot more upset. But I've seen people saying, like, how can you just sort of wave your hand and move away from this? They didn't really get into the issue of integrity because it wasn't an issue. It wasn't something Scalise had called out. They basically said the things he has asked for have happened. And the other complaint we heard about the hearing was that during this hearing process, Republican Board of Elections member Bruce Kemp actually took a brief break, got up from the dais, left the room with the attorney who was representing Scalise. And there were a bunch of questions about whether or not that was even allowed. In fact, Chair Derek Mailer asked out loud if that was allowed from his seat as chair. So we did a little digging. We looked through the law. People had pointed out that Kemp donated to Scalise's campaign. And at the end of the day, basically, there's not a conflict of interest here. The law specifically says Board of Election members are totally allowed to donate to any candidate they want. And in North Carolina, the duty to vote, meaning like you can't recuse yourself unless you have a really good reason, considers financial interest in a pretty specific, pretty narrow way. You have to stand to gain or lose quite a bit of money. It has to be a significant impact. So if you make, you know, $80,000 a year, losing $1,000 might not even count.
And I don't know that donating counts as losing or winning it, because that money is spent whether or not that candidate wins or loses.
Exactly. It's not an investment that could bear returns or lose returns. As for getting up from the dais and going to talk to someone who's associated with the protest, that's unclear. But the board really didn't pursue it because everything in their eyes was pretty much moot at that point. But we wanted to let you know that, yes, we heard your complaints. We heard complaints from Democrats. We heard complaints from Republicans. So that was sort of our take on the meeting. But after the hearing quest, they went on to the, frankly, amazing but kind of boring business of rectifying the votes, which is where they have an accounting of everything that happened during early voting and election day, and then they finalize the votes.
So that's where we stand. We talked about the election results. Dane Scalise, Bill Rivenbark, the two incumbents staying on the county commission, as well as Stephanie Walker. And then at the Board of Education, we have Judy Justice, Tim Merrick, and David Perry.
That's right. But for now, I think these are our big takeaways. Yes, the New Hanover County Board of Elections appears to have broken the law, or at the very least, acted in a way that was pretty obviously contrary to it. Yes, it caused a ton of confusion and frustration. Yes, lack of communication definitely made that worse. No, we never saw any evidence of voter fraud or any rationale at all that we should toss ballots. That is unconstitutional and not a thing we should do lightly, ever. And that seems to be the general consensus of pretty much everyone I talk to in election world. The underlying cause of this appears to be, whatever you think of the decision, a lack of staff and resources. The county's opinion is that they are giving the Board of Elections enough resources to get the job done. The Board of Elections, at least some of the members, don't appear to agree. I think it will be an important conversation in the spring about whether or not more resources, maybe a full-time employee or two, would help make sure that this doesn't happen ever again. And I will say, I've spoken to Democrats and Republicans who would be okay with that because, look, we hear a lot of talk about election integrity as a veil over lies about election security, you know, Trump's big lie in 2020. But there's no reason not to take election integrity seriously, to really want to make sure that every vote counts and that the process is transparent and fair. And if that costs a little more, I think most people would be okay with it.
I do think part of the irony of this is it's a little bit of an unfunded mandate. What we've seen is that there's these new election laws that come in that really restrain where and when and how these counts can actually occur. And it makes it so there's more need for resources to complete the work. And you see what happens if those resources aren't available. It leads to more and more of these questions about the integrity of the election. I'm kind of hoping that we stop passing so many laws changing how elections are supposed to work so that people can kind of develop an expectation that's going to be accurate in future years, because the changing from year to year, from election to election, is part of the disorientation that leads to a lot of fear and misinformation, I think.
As I agree 100%. I think the issues here that came out of miscommunication or lack of communication are, you know, pretty self-evident. Maybe more funding is the answer to that. One of the things I've heard suggested is that the Board of Elections have its own communications officer. I do know that they get year-round a lot of public records requests, but at an even more basic level, I think the idea here is that the public's faith in the election system has been really strained over the last 4 years. And I think if there is a way to put people's minds at rest, if there are procedures, if there's extra funding that makes those procedures possible, that makes people feel more confident in the election system, that's worth at least talking about.
And I will say, having reported on this, I have full confidence in this election system. And I think that every reporter who's reported on this, who's seen these emails, who's heard from the Board of Elections, we all agree that this was a safe, secure election, that the votes were counted that needed to be counted. And I want to make sure that I reiterate that, because it's important that we say this was a fair, free, and carefully conducted election.
Absolutely, yeah. This is not a story about election fraud. This is a story about a potentially underfunded agency that didn't communicate very well. All right, Kelly Kinoyer, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
All right, well, we need to take another quick break, but we'll be back in just a moment with my colleague Rachel Keith to help us dig into the frankly staggering amount of campaign finance funding that went into the 2024 election here in southeastern North Carolina. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. So, it wouldn't be a campaign season without campaign finance. Now, love it or loathe it, we saw some record-breaking amounts of campaign donations this year. Roughly $700,000 on local races alone, and millions of dollars spent on our state house races. With me now to help unpack the issue of campaign finance is my colleague Rachel Keith. Rachel, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So it has been a long campaign season, and I want to start out at the top here talking about why we are just now talking about campaign finance after the election is mostly over.
That's right, because this quarter three report, so these candidates have to file for quarter one, quarter two, and quarter three, and this quarter three report is due right before election day. So we're kind of scrambling to cover the lead up to the election. And then we look at the results, and then we look at the money that potentially helped those results or not. That's a hard determination to make, but that's what we're here to kind of unpack right now.
Exactly, yeah. A lot of times the reports don't come in on the day they're due, which is the 29th of October. They come in sometimes even after election day.
And there are some candidates who have not filed, and I've had to email and say, hey, could you please send this?
Exactly. And just as a note here, as we get into some of the state house races, for these races, we're just talking about the quarter three reports, so this is not all inclusive. It does give you a good picture of overall spending and overall receipts, but some individual donors may have given earlier in the race. Early fundraising is obviously an important part of campaigning. So here we're kind of hitting some of the highlights, but at the end of the show, we'll have some notes on how you can do this stuff yourself if you really want to get granular. And we will have some more reporting coming out next week that will include some of the other reports.
That's correct. But we do have the totals that are listed on quarter three. So we know how much they did spend and brought in overall. It's just we have to compile all three because they're not in a nice package for us.
Exactly. All right. So let's get started. Let's talk about the most expensive race, at least here locally. And that was for State Senate District 7. As we have discussed before on the show, this is most of New Hanover County. There's a sizable chunk of downtown Wilmington that is now part of District 8. But by and large, this is the district that represents New Hanover County. This was the race between longtime incumbent Republican Michael Lee and challenger Democrat David Hill and also John Evans. That's John with an H-N, not WECT's anchor in front of the show, John Evans, who was a Libertarian candidate who did take about 4% of the overall vote. But his fundraising didn't really play a huge role in this, and I don't think his votes were enough to shape the overall race. So let's get into Lee and Hill's fundraising.
Yeah, so Michael Lee raised $3.3 million, and about $2.1 million came from the North Carolina Senate Majority Fund. And we see in Michael Lee, he has tons of political action committee funding as well. And we'll see that they also got behind candidates like House Representative Ted Davis and Senate District 8 Bill Raven. And we do see, I'll go through, there are some PACs that supported David Hill. But from quarter three, we see some highlights, some major players. Roy and Vanessa Carroll of Carroll Companies each gave about $6,400. That's typically the maximum in one election cycle.
Yeah, and many of you will remember that the Carroll Companies are behind the Avenue development on Military Cutoff, a major mixed-use development that Michael Lee was an attorney for. There were some other major contributors, too.
Yes. In quarter three, we also saw Catherine Truitt's committee contributing $6,400. And again, she did not get her bid to run again for the Republicans for the state superintendent. So that campaign gave to Michael Lee. We have Brian Eckel. We'll talk about him from Cape Fear Commercial. He gave the $6,400 for quarter three. We have Bobby Huckabee. We'll see his name show up again. He is part of Southland Amusements. There are some gambling games in this company. We have Laura and Dee Logan. They are of Logan Homes. They each gave about $6,400. And this is interesting. Laura is Stephanie Walker's sister, who got second in the New Hanover County Commission race.
Yeah, family politics.
Family politics.
Yeah. So it's worth noting that this was probably one of the most competitive Senate districts in the state. There are some that are sort of irrevocably Democrat or more often Republican. This is a very competitive race, so both parties put a lot of money into it. It can be a little easy to let that money sort of obscure how much money also came from individual donors. But even if you take out the big spend by the Senate Majority Fund, there's still a lot of local people who put money into this race.
Absolutely.
All right, so let's move on to David Hill's fundraising. Not as much as Lee, but no slouch with about, I think you told me, $1.4 million?
Yes, that's correct. And again, like Lee, we have political parties getting involved. We have close to $834,000 coming from the Democratic Party mostly. Some of David Hill's bigger donors in quarter three were Elizabeth Hedden Panko. She is formerly of SDI Construction. Elizabeth gave $6,784 to Hill's campaign. We have Mary Weber Baggett. She used to own the Blockade Runner. She gave the $6,400. John Sproul, it looks like he's a conservationist in the area. He gave about $6,400. And then when we talk about political action committees, we have Planned Parenthood giving to David Hill for about $6,000 and the NC Sierra Club about $5,000.
Now, here's what I found was interesting. Most of this money that was received by the Hill and Lee campaigns went into advertising. And we've talked about this ad nauseum in the past, television ads and mailers and all that. But right across the river and in downtown Wilmington, in Senate District 8, that's a longtime Republican incumbent Bill Raven, possibly one of the most powerful men in the General Assembly, was running against Catherine Cady Randall. In his race, Raven, on paper, raised a ton of money, but it didn't really go to advertising.
Yes, it went to other committees. He, I'm sure, did the calculus that it was not a competitive race for him because Catherine Randall, actually her committee name is Catherine Randall to End Partisan Gerrymandering, and she made that a point in her opener at our candidate forum that was hosted by WECT, HQR, and Port City Daily that she was running because she represented that notch that used to be in Lee's district. And she's saying, I just wanted to draw attention to this. And it's pretty interesting that Catherine Randall, I mean, she only raised close to $5,000. And some in quarter three, they were just $250 contributions from individuals, like people like physicians or people in philanthropy. But if you look at Bill Rabin, it's the story of the Political Action Committee. I mean, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Catawba Nation, Duke Energy, Emerge Ortho, NC Auto Dealers, NC Home Builders, NC Realtors, NC Restaurant. A lot of anesthesiologist PACs gave as well, and they gave the $6,400 in quarter three. So it's a very different story between these two candidates.
Yeah, and again, over $500,000 of the total that he spent during the election campaign, I think it was $550,000, went to the North Carolina Senate Majority Fund, which is the fund that helped pay for Lee's campaign. So you can kind of see how the network of fundraising and spending works here. It goes beyond individual races.
Right, because Bill Rabin technically was safe, right?
Yeah.
And that was the calculus. So his fundraising would go to, like you said, people like Michael Lee.
So let's move on to some of the House races we covered. In House District 20, this is kind of the northern part of New Hanover County, we had Republican incumbent Ted Davis, who ran against Democratic challenger John Berger. It was a tough race. I think Davis won by a pretty comfortable margin, 10 points. But the fundraising story was kind of interesting.
So actually, Jonathan Berger, the Democrat, raised more money than Ted Davis. He raised $276,000, close to $277,000. And a lot of, you know, a good chunk, again, came from the North Carolina Democratic Caucus in quarter three. They gave him close to $66,000. We have Bagot, Mary Weber Bagot, again, the one of the former owners of the Blockade Runner, giving $6,400 to Jonathan Berger. Progressive Turnout gave $2,250 to Jonathan. We have Virginia Wright. She listed that she works for L'Oreal, and she raised close to $5,000 for him.
Yeah, and this is just a tough race. Ted Davis has a lot of name recognition. I think it's safe to say this is a fairly gerrymandered district that doesn't touch a lot of the more left-leaning parts of central Wilmington. So just a really tough race, and this is a case where fundraising wasn't able to make the difference.
Yeah, because these are, you know, this is Castle Hayne. This is Wrightsboro.
Yep, it's my neck of the woods. Judging just by lawn signs alone, you can tell it leans a bit more conservative. So, all right, let's look on the other side of this race, though, and talk about Ted Davis's fundraising, because it's not like he raised nothing.
Yeah, he raised close to $171,000, and the big chunk, again, came from the North Carolina Republican Party that gave him close to $43,000. One of his leading donors, some of them for quarter three, $6,400 came for Citizens of Destin Hall. You ask, who is that? Actually, Destin Hall won his race pretty significantly, and he represents counties like Caldwell and Watauga, and he's taking over for Tim Moore. He's the next Speaker of the House.
Yeah, Tim Moore, who has moved on to Congress, again, in a fairly safe, gerrymandered congressional district.
That's right. And we have the Wilmington Anesthesiologist PAC giving $3,000 to Ted Davis. Bobby Huckabee, we talked about, gave to Michael Lee, who's part of this gaming organization, gave the $6,400. Technically, he lists himself as the president of Southland Amusement and Gaming. And yeah, that's kind of a picture that we have for Ted Davis.
So next week, we'll have some more reporting on some of the other House races. We had some candidates who didn't really raise as much. Some of these races were pretty safe for the Republicans, including Charlie Miller, Frank Eiler. Deb Butler, of course, a Democrat, longtime Democrat, ran against a writing candidate, and she didn't really have to do very much work. I mean, she took a vast majority of the vote there.
Yeah, and she didn't really fundraise at all. I looked through all the reports and there was barely any information. So, I mean, she thought that she was safe and didn't need to fundraise.
And the ballots proved her correct.
Right.
Yeah, so I want to pivot now and talk about some of our local county races, because this is where you have really gone deep and sort of dug into what the industries represented by individual donors that supported specific candidates look like. So we kind of have a map of who's supporting who here. So let's get into this. Let's talk about our county commission race first. Who's our top fundraiser here?
Our top fundraiser was Republican incumbent Dane Scalise. He raised $276,000. As we saw, that this is more than some of the House races in our area. And so we have some major Republican establishment and power brokers in this county who supported him. For example, Adam Sosny of McAdams Homes and MFH Construction, he gave about $9,600. We have Brian Eckel of Cape Fear Commercial, the $6,400. Calvin Wells also works there. David Honeycutt of Honeycutt Construction Services. William Purvis of Liberty Senior Living. And we have another developer, James Yop, who gave the maximum to Dane.
Yeah, a quick note here as we're making our way through this. Some of you will hear numbers that are higher than $6,400, which was the recently increased maximum individual contribution for a candidate. We asked around about this. We haven't gotten total clarity, but it appears that if you donate earlier in the year before the primary election, so that could actually be the end of 2023 or early in this year, you get a different limit cap. Same amount. So you can give up to $6,400 before the primary election, and then you sort of get a reset before the general election. So we did see people go over that $6,400.
Yeah, and there was one for Dane. That was Christopher Lutet of Lutet Law, and he gave the $6,400 plus $6,400, which is the $12,800. And they actually worked together on the North Carolina Industrial Commission.
And so we saw this funding go into billboards and mailers and TV ads. You may have seen the ads with the dog. They were kind of adorable. Not heavy on policy, though. I don't think we learned a lot about what Dane was representing from those. But a lot of money went to this campaign. It was a pretty well-organized campaign. He was, again, trying to kind of break in here a little bit. Dane's sort of a quasi-incumbent. He was appointed in 2023, so he's now running in this race for his first full term, running against Bill Rivenbark and Jonathan Barfield, both incumbents, and we'll talk about them in a minute. But there was some sense in his campaign that he really, really needed to get his name out there. Based on the tentative results that we've discussed this week, it looks like that was effective. He came in third of three seats, so it looks like he will be back on the commission. I want to talk about someone who's not going to get back on the commission, but also did some fundraising this cycle. That was John Hinnant, Republican challenger John Hinnant.
Yes, he was the second fundraiser at about $90,000, and he came in fifth in the race. And his top donors were from the NC Realtors PAC, who gave him $6,000. The New Hanover County GOP gave him $5,000. And then Caldwell Banker, Seacoast Advantage CEO Timothy Lee Millam gave $3,000. Millam also donated $5,500 to Dane. We also have Edward Clark. He's the president of Bill Clark Homes. He was a top donor. And Frank and Ramsey Gorham, they each donated $2,500.
And again, you can go online and check out Rachel's more in-depth reporting, and you can actually see some visual representation of how these various industries or donors from various industries and dollars from various industries supported Hinnant. Moving on, we had the last of the Republican candidates, Bill Rivenbark, who did half a term on the school board starting in 2018 and then served a full term from 2020 to 2024 and is currently the chair.
Yes, and he was the top vote getter, and he brought in close to $72,000. And if you look through these campaign finance reports, and I'll tell you how to look through those in a moment, but these donors are very similar to all of the Republican candidates. Like, you see the same names show up on Dane Scalise and John Hinnant's reports. But if you look at Bill's top donors, most of them came from Cape Fear Commercial, where his brother and Charlie Rivenbark, he's also a city councilman. He's a senior vice president. He donated about $2,000. We have Brian Eckel again, $6,000. Mike Brown also works at Cape Fear Commercial. He gave $3,000. And Spurl Thompson gave $1,000. And again, these are all Cape Fear Commercial people. And yeah, and we see that Eckel gave to Scalise, you know, he gave a little more. And then he gave just $500 to Hinnant. So it was interesting to see how these same donors, a lot of times they didn't give across the board. Sometimes they did the same amount. Sometimes they varied those.
Yeah. Rivenbark also got support from the Lower Cape Fear Republican Women and the Home Builders Association $250 from John Lennon's campaign from 2023.
And those show up on the other two Republican candidates as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think one takeaway here, I think, is that anecdotally from donors I spoke to is that they had a sense that Bill Reifenbach was safe. 4 years ago, he was the top vote getter. This year turned out the same way. Whereas, again, Scalise was at a little bit of a disadvantage, being less of a well-known quantity. So that uphill battle, that's where you really see people kind of dig in with their support. So let's talk about the Democratic candidates in the commissioner's race. Top fundraiser was Cassidy Santaguida, newcomer to politics.
Yeah, so Cassidy Santaguida, just over $65,000. And so you could see the top three fundraisers were the Republicans, followed by the Democrats. And her top contributor was Dorothy Weiss of Vantaka. She gave close to $5,000. Kathleen Jones, same deal. And then Jessica Cannon of Wilmington Health gave just over $4,000. And Beth Crookham, who identifies as a film producer in these reports, also gave about $4,000. And in these other reports, you'll see that the GOP politicians back the GOP candidates, right? And so we have our Democratic politicians showing up for Cassidy. For example, Marsha Morgan was $2,450. Deb Butler, we just talked about her briefly, gave $1,000. Commissioner Rob Zappel, who is on the board for two more years, gave $800. We have City Councilor Celette Andrew giving $300. So that's some examples of those supporters from within the Democratic Party.
Yeah. So as the top fundraiser and the lowest vote getter, you might say that money didn't make a difference. I would disagree. I think if you look at the actual ballot behavior, you learn a couple things. One is that not every person who was Democratic voted all the way straight down the ballot. Not everyone voted for all three commissioners. There were a lot of people, over 50,000, basically votes, quote unquote, left on the table, which means people voted for two commissioner candidates or one commissioner candidate. So those are the undervotes. So what Santaguida had to do was sort of get her name out there and get people who even were already registered Democrats to vote for her, and then had to win over unaffiliated votes and maybe even a few Republican votes. So she did come several thousand votes below the top three candidates, but to come from relative obscurity and sort of get in the mix, I think that's what fundraising can help you do.
And we've been talking about PACs, and you know, we're not seeing the degree of PACs show up in these county races like they do in the House and Senate, but we do have, you know, the Back to One PAC. It's a political action committee associated with IOTC Local 491. They represent film technicians in a union representing the Carolinas and parts of Georgia. And she got just over $1,000 from the Democratic Party.
So let's move on to Jonathan Barfield, like we mentioned, longtime Democratic incumbent. Currently in fourth place, raised a little over $59,000.
Yeah, so his top contributor was Rayford Trask of the Trask Land Company, who contributed $6,200 to Barfield, and that was followed by the NC Realtors PAC. They gave $6,000. And we heard about Adam Sosny, and he was one of the bigger donors to Scalise, and he also gave to Barfield, and he gave $5,000. And we're seeing some Republican backers show up in Jonathan Barfield's campaign finance. We have Seacoast CEO Millam, who gave $2,500 to him. And then Brian Eckel gave $2,000. The NC Builders Association gave $2,000.
Yeah, I think one thing we can say here, and we saw this in 2020, there was I believe it was the Realtors PAC, ported Deb Hayes and Jonathan Barfield, so a Republican candidate and Democratic candidate. And a lot of these times, these industry groups don't have, or people who are in certain industries aren't necessarily voting in ideological terms. They're thinking about which commissioners will be reasonable when it comes to decisions that will benefit our industry.
Jonathan Barfield is a real estate person.
Yeah, and he's in the real estate world. So yeah. I think, you know, someone like Kiefer Commercial or the Realtors PAC or someone who works in the rental business is thinking like, okay, who's not going to be implementing a housing moratorium or something like that?
Right. And he's been in power for a very long time. So they know him. They've watched him on the dais for a long time and they wanted to give to him as well.
Yeah, so let's talk about one of the, maybe a little bit of a political surprise this time around. Stephanie Walker, who just is currently wrapping up a 40-year term on the school board and is now the, with current vote totals, the second place in the commissioner, so it's the second of three seats in commissioner.
Yes, she raised close to $20,000, and her biggest supporter was her husband, Lori, who donated $2,050 to her, and her daughter even donated $500. Following Lori is the NC Democratic Party that gave her the $1,050, and then Beth Crookham, we talked about her, she gave $1,000. So she had smaller donations, and it's interesting to see that the Democratic Party, they gave a lot more money to Cassidy Santaguida over Stephanie Walker. And she did have the name recognition out there, and I think she counted on that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's often the calculus political parties have to make. They have to look at what are the most competitive races, what are the candidates that need the most help to get that name recognition. You know, Walker is a classic example of someone who combined name recognition with outreach and hoping people have been paying attention to her on the school board, raised the least, but did quite well in the polls. So whenever we talk about campaign finance, it is pretty clear that you can raise enough money to get your name out there in the public. It doesn't always translate into a win.
That's right. And I did ask her about her fundraising, and she said, you know, I just raised what I needed. And she said that she did billboards, she did signs, but she did not do commercials. She did not do mailer. She didn't think it was necessary. So she felt like she's been in the community long enough. People have seen her on the school board. She's born and raised here. She's served on other county commissions before that. And so she relied on that.
All right. So if you're interested in this stuff and you want to get even more granular and see some fun graphics that our colleague Kelly Kinoyer put together and learn more about fundraising for the Board of Education race, I will have links to Rachel's deep dive online. But for now, we got to wrap up the show. But before we go, there's two things we want to talk about. First is how you yourself can be a citizen journalist and look up this stuff on your own. If there are races we didn't talk about that you're interested in, if there's future races, you can even go back in time and look at fundraising totals from 2020 or 2018, whatever you want to check out. Rachel, how can people do this?
It's important for us in the media. We need to tell you how we're doing our work, and you can go behind us. And we're happy to make corrections if we made a mistake, but you can see for yourself. So what you will do is for our county races that I mentioned, you will go to the New Hanover County Board of Elections site, and you will look up the campaign committee forms. And so what you will see if you click on that are individual folders for each candidate for 2024. And then you will see all the quarter filings that they have to submit. So you can go behind us and look for yourself to see who gave to these candidates.
Right. And for bigger races, you know, governor's races, state house races, a lot of those live on a very similar website that's on the state. Again, we'll have links to all of this on the page and a little mini tutorial. So if you want to try this yourself, I encourage you to do it. It's really interesting. And this is all public record. It's something that is pretty accessible. Okay. And the second thing I want to talk about is why we talk about campaign finance. And I just want to say that the reason we do this is not to shame people or celebrate people for who they are giving money to. But as we have seen in elections, while it is not a surefire win, money in campaigns helps people get their message out and it helps people win. It definitely impacts the results of elections. And because of that, we think it is important to understand who is helping to move the needle on these issues.
Yes, and we can see if you look through the reports yourself that we just told you to do, you can see power structures lining up for certain candidates. And you can explore that and see, wow, this is a lot of real estate money. Wow, this is a lot of construction money. This is a lot of PAC money. This person relied on individual donors rather than large players in the community. So you can go and see those patterns for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. We think it's important for you to understand not just who the candidates are and what they represent, what their policies are, but the power structures around them that are helping them get and stay in power.
That's correct.
All right, Rachel Keith, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Ben.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Newsroom. Thanks to my colleagues Kelly Kinoyer and Rachel Keith for joining me on the show today, and Ken Campbell, as always, for technical support. If you missed any part of the program, you can find it at whqr.org or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have comments, concerns, or an idea for a future show, email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening,
and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.